Hey, this is the Football Diary Podcast. Welcome back. This is Mike with Miles and Dave, and we're talking about the football transfer rumour mill, which is in overdrive at the end of June, as we know. And there's a couple of clubs in the middle of everything in the minute, it seems, apart from Chelsea, of course, and that's Arsenal and Manchester United. And we'll be delving into their potential signings, or not, as the case may be, in a moment. And also England's under-21s are out in the tournament as well. They are in the quarterfinals now and progressing really, really well. So we'll be talking about their progress and some key players there too. But starting off with Arsenal, I think, Miles, if we go there and talk about the targets they've had, there's three in particular that catch the eye, aren't there? Still very much up in the air about who will go where, but one that seems almost definite is Kai Havertz. Declan Rice looked like he was on his way to Arsenal, very close to it, until Manchester City intervened. You heard it here first, right? And also Jurrien Timber as well has been linked too, who, again, linked heavily to Manchester United last season. Very sort of dependable, solid-looking centre-back alternative for them. So how do you think it's going to play out for Arsenal? Who do you think they prioritise out of them? And what is the likelihood of them landing any of them, would you say?
Well, I think two of the three are pretty much done now. I think we'll see Havertz and Timber there next season, which is, they're excellent additions for the Arsenal squad. It's where they kind of fit in, because Arsenal certainly need depth in their defence. We know that. But is Timber the kind of player that's happy to be depth, or is he a starter? I wonder who he kind of replaces if he is, because he's very versatile and can play across the back line at fullback and centre back, and also can play in a holding midfield. So there's a chance that maybe he's their answer to Thomas Partey moving on as well. I think Arteta has been quite smart at trying to bring players into the squad that can cover a variety of positions, because then all they need to do is consistently train within that system and they will be able to fit in a bit more in that kind of total football style. So Timber makes a lot of sense. That'll be done pretty soon. And Havertz looks like that's pretty much nailed on now, doesn't it? And I think that's the more interesting of the signings, because Declan Rice would be exciting, but it makes a lot of sense. You know, obviously, where he goes into this Arsenal team. Whereas Havertz, it takes a bit more tweaking. And I think actually that's probably what Arteta's got in mind for it.
So I'll stay with you then, Miles. Thinking about Havertz as well, I think he's had his medical today, I think, from what I hear. So the announcement's imminent. I mean, Arsenal's attack has been really predictable this season, but in a good way, because they've all performed so well. Can you see him replacing the likes of Gabriel Jesus, maybe? Do you think that's the kind of role they'll play for him? Because, I mean, he has played out wide in the past. He has played a bit deeper. Chelsea have been playing him as almost like a false nine. How do you think he'll fit into Arsenal's forward line?
So the good thing is he provides that depth because, again, like Timber, he's very, very versatile, as you say, and he can play as the number 10, the number 9. He can play on either wing. And we know that last season, the amount of games Arsenal had to play, someone like Saka, for example, definitely needed some time out of the team. Now, they added Trossard in January, which added a bit of depth. They've obviously got Nketiah around as well. So I actually wonder if Havertz is more going to cover the number 10 position, because you noticed a lot last season that Odegaard was always the one to get substituted. Even though he's the one that kind of has it in him to unlock a team, it seemed that very often 70 minutes would hit, Odegaard would come off and Saka would stay on the pitch. So I wonder if actually he provides a bit of an option there. And I don't think it's in place of Odegaard. I think for me, where I see Havertz fitting into this Arsenal team is the number 10 behind Jesus, and then dropping Odegaard deeper into the midfield. I don't think it makes sense. I've seen a lot of people talking about how Havertz might replace Xhaka and kind of play as that left-sided number 8. But actually, I think that suits Odegaard far more. I think his work rate off the ball enables him to kind of improve the defensive qualities of his game a lot more than someone like Havertz will. And also, like you mentioned, I think sometimes Arsenal's attack could be quite predictable. And it became a point where if a team managed to mark Odegaard out of the game, Arsenal couldn't create anything. But dropping him deeper and putting Havertz in that number 10 role gives the opposition something else to think about. And actually, what you might find is if the opposition's holding midfielder is desperate to track Odegaard, he'll follow him deeper on the pitch. And that opens up a lot of space for Havertz to operate in with Jesus. So I feel like actually we've kind of questioned, well, who does Havertz replace? It could be Xhaka, but in a very different role. We might actually see Odegaard doing that. And I think Arsenal will do that a lot this summer. Some of the players that are moving on, I think they've already got answers for them in the squad. Thomas Partey moving on. Perhaps we see Ben White move into midfield, or perhaps Zinchenko, which I think is more likely. He becomes their holding midfielder, and they have Kieran Tierney at left back already, or maybe they improve. So they've got a lot of gaps to fill, but actually, because like I mentioned earlier, Arteta's versatile squad, they can fill those gaps really quickly.
It's interesting, isn't it? You think about the kind of philosophy that Arteta's trying to impose on Arsenal. It's younger players, but again, like you say, it's this hallmark of versatility as well. And Dave, I think the players that they've been earmarking so far as being close to being completed, Havertz especially, Timber as well, their versatility, as Miles was saying, could be valuable to them, couldn't they? They're trying to close that gap with Manchester City. It's going to take a heck of a step up in quality, first of all, which these will undoubtedly be. But in terms of the way their team plays as well, it could change the shape quite a bit, couldn't it? It could offer freshness to a team, like we were saying, looked like you could pick itself at the end of the season.
Yeah, and I think that was the question last season, wasn't it? A lot, I think, whether Arsenal could maintain that run that they were on, and if they did lose a couple of players through injury, would replacements be able to come into the team and make and obviously have the same performance levels that those are obviously the first 11? And I think we did see them struggle a little bit when they did lose a couple of players, which I think it's, you know, imperative that they've managed to get another centre-back in. I think it'll be interesting to see if he's able to kind of cement a place in the first 11, considering how good Arsenal were with the two first-choice centre-backs last season. I don't think he'll push Saliba out of the first 11, so I think it will be a case of whether he is pushed into that second centre-back position or whether he does actually operate on that right-hand side. Obviously, let's not forget they've got Tomiyasu in there as well. I'm not sure if they'll probably be looking to move him on if Timber comes in and plays at full-back. But yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with Havertz. I think he got a lot of criticism last season, and I think some of it probably slightly unfair just because of how dysfunctional that Chelsea team was. We know he's a really good young talent, and we've seen, you know, him play some really good games, obviously won the Champions League with Chelsea. And I feel like playing in this Arsenal team is going to be a completely different proposition altogether. The football that Arsenal play is so much better than what Chelsea play. They're a far more functional team. Like Miles was saying, he's going to be able to offer link-up play in a position that potentially is at a false nine if Jesus isn't playing. And I think that sort of relationship that he'll be able to have with Saka and Martinelli, I think that'll be, you know, really interesting to watch. But I think, for me, it is an interesting one because you don't know who he's going to displace. And I think that's quite an exciting problem to have, really. And it's something that Arteta will be able to obviously look at, and it'll be interesting to see what he does in pre-season to see how he does kind of use him. And I suppose we'll see some answers when that happens.
Yeah, with Havertz as well. When I saw him playing for Leverkusen, it was his highlights reel in the Bundesliga was very much this dynamic forward that interchanged positions with other players of similar quality or better, created space for others, but he also needed others to create space for him. And I think in his last few months at Chelsea, that forward line was so static. There was no obvious goal threat. He had to become the goal threat, but there was no obvious service to him either. I think it was unfair on him to have that role when the team was so dysfunctional up front. Yeah. This Arsenal team is so much more different, isn't it, going forward?
I think one thing we have that we've not really seen from him of late is a lot of the goals I saw him score for Leverkusen, he was arriving into the box, kind of timing those runs in. And I don't feel like he's really been able to do that because of the way that Chelsea have actually played this, particularly in the last year. They seem to really kind of camp teams into their own box, and they're not able to make those transitions as quickly as they would, whereas Arsenal are a completely different animal altogether. I feel like it's a team that's just going to suit his style of play so much better. And, you know, hopefully we see sort of his old self, really. I think that's...
With Arsenal, though... With Arsenal, it was all about elevating the quality, wasn't it, of the people that weren't necessarily starting, because when they were coming in to replace the obvious starters, it wasn't an immediate upgrade. It was a massive downgrade for the most part. But Havertz, wherever he starts or doesn't start, it means there's now depth, doesn't it, Miles? It means that there's now quality and depth. And I think it's a difficult gig for a player to sign for a club thinking I could potentially be a backup, isn't it? Do you think that's the case for some players if they do sign them, that they've got such an obvious, strong attacking team that anyone that does come in those positions is probably going to have to be backup to begin with?
It's funny, isn't it? Because in the attacking positions, we've seen a lot of clubs kind of have that mentality over the last couple of years where we've seen them sign players that you think you needed something else. We think of Tottenham spending big money on Richarlison last summer. Liverpool seemed to have only refreshed their attacking line for the last like three transfer windows. And you, there is a real thing about strengthening from a position of strength. That is a really good thing to do. And Arsenal, let's not forget, although they pushed Man City quite far in the league, they got knocked out of the Europa League to Sporting Lisbon and are now stepping up to the Champions League. So if they weren't quite good enough to cut in the Europa League with the depth that they had last year, they obviously need to improve if they want to make their Champions League campaign even remotely successful. So it is really important that you encourage players. And I think the good thing is Arsenal have got an exciting enough project now that people will want to be a part of it. Yeah. Even if they're not guaranteed to start every single game, there's enough fixtures in that calendar that players will go there. What I wonder is the current youngsters at Arsenal, I wonder how they feel about it. Emil Smith Rowe is back from injury, and we'll talk about him a bit later on, I'm sure, when we come to the England under 21s. But where does this leave him? Because that's another player that you think is above him in the pecking order. At the end of the season, when he got back to fitness, it was really hard for him to get minutes. Rhys Nelson's just signed a new deal. Nketiah signed a deal last year. Balogun is back, which I imagine he'll move on. But there's a lot of players that were there that are looking at Havertz coming in and going, does that mean my future's not here? But it's a hard balance, and hopefully that's something Arteta will work on. I think it does seem like there's a lot more squad harmony at this Arsenal team than there has been over the last few years. So I trust him to manage it. But I think you've got to be impressed with Timber and Havertz if they come in, even if they weren't necessarily the priority positions. I'm just interested to see if that's all Arsenal do. Obviously, we know they want Declan Rice, but if they do for some reason miss out on him, then what? Do they readdress their strategy? Are there other players that they've been lined up for? Because it's gone very, very quiet on everyone but those three.
Yeah. With Rice as well, if he was to come to Arsenal, he's probably one of the few players that would actually immediately upgrade that team as well. You know, he's such a high quality player. And you said in our kind of deep dive onto Declan Rice's next move, how Man City would probably be the obvious destination in your eyes for a player to replace Ilkay Gundogan. So now he's actually gone to Barcelona, they're going to be looking for a player almost to fill such a huge hole that he provided for Man City. Rice seems to be a great like-for-like option for that, doesn't he? Because he can play box-to-box. But if he was to go for Arsenal, what would it take for him to go to Arsenal ahead of Man City? Do you think that it is purely just about, okay, this is more of a purer sporting ambition than Man City? Do you maybe that comes into it? Does money talk? Does pure ambition and drive come into it? What's Rice thinking right now, do you think?
I think the thing is, even though Man City have got the money, because they've got Guardiola, it's still sporting interests that move people to Man City. You obviously have the financial benefit, but right now, is there a club in European football that you'd rather play for than Man City? Yes, Arsenal play fantastic football, but if you know, if you're looking at the treble winners and Pep Guardiola's side, and you're going to have someone like Erling Haaland in front of you and De Bruyne to provide you with the ball when you need it, I don't think you can question whether someone would move to Man City for sporting reasons. I think you absolutely would. I think the only things that might draw someone to Arsenal instead are the excitement of being the challenger, the excitement of that young project that Arteta's trying to build. If you buy into Arteta's philosophy, then maybe you think they can challenge Man City in the coming years. Plus, for someone like Rice, he's London-based. That it's mental, but that does weigh into people's thinking, doesn't it? I think the fact that it would be a smoother transition, you don't really think of that as being an issue for people. When you see someone like Aaron Ramsey playing for Nice and his family still live in Cardiff, you think that it's kind of a given that a footballer would just go where they need to go. So, I don't know. There's still a glimmer for Arsenal. I think West Ham seem to be more keen to do business with them for some reason. And Man City still haven't put a concrete offer in. I wonder if because they're looking at Guardiola right now, and that would be the majority of their budget, and they've already brought Kovacic in for quite a reduced fee. I feel like Declan Rice is more, we're going for him now, because if we don't get him now, we won't get him for a long time.
Yeah.
And we know he's someone we want for the future, rather than a player that they identified as, that's our priority for this summer. But we've seen big clubs do that all the time. There was a period of time where Chelsea, and probably Man United actually, just signed anyone available in the Premier League to stop one of their rivals from getting them. And Declan Rice strengthens Arsenal. If Man City can bring him in, it's not like it would be detrimental to them.
Very true, yeah. I think if they saw him go to Arsenal when they could have intervened, it's a bit like United taking Ronaldo off City just so they couldn't have him. Yeah. It's almost an element of like spite about it, isn't there? But Declan Rice has got options, and he's a really exciting player to see develop, I think, whoever he goes to. But another player we want to zoom in on as well, and starting a conversation about Manchester United,
his best mate
is Mason Mount. So Mason Mount has been linked heavily with United. I think from what we're hearing from the Mason Mount camp, he wants to leave Chelsea, right? So United have tabled, I think the most recent bid is 55 million. He's in the final year of his contract. So what is his value? It's hard to gauge, isn't it? And how much do you think United have to push to get there, to get him to the club? Do you want him at the club, first of all, as well? Is that a priority for United, do you think? What are your thoughts on the Mount situation, Dave?
I think kind of before it came to light, he wasn't a name that sort of jumped out to me to think that's the sort of, you know, player that we do need. I think the one thing that he will offer us is a lot of strength in depth. And he's certainly going to come in, take place in the squad, if not the first team. And he's going to give us, you know, the kind of player that he is. He's a much better player than the likes of Fred and McTominay. And I mean, that's kind of setting the bar a little bit low. I don't know, disrespect to those two players, but they shouldn't be starting for Manchester United. And I think Mason Mount, the profile that he has, I think what does appeal to Ten Hag is his versatility. He can play in a number of positions, but he is quite effective in the press, which we know obviously is what Southgate also likes in him as well. He can play sort of anywhere, sort of along across the midfield, sort of as an 8 or a 10. And then he's obviously played off of the wing for Chelsea. And I'm pretty sure Chelsea fans haven't been too happy when he has played on the wing. But I think it'll be a smart acquisition. I really do, to be honest. And I've warmed more to the idea the more I've heard about it and the more I've kind of looked into his stats and his numbers over the last, you know, 2 or 3 years. Obviously, this season, it's been one to forget for him, but pretty much everyone in that team. But if you look at his profile and what he will be able to bring in, I think it would be really smart. And he's definitely going to be a systemic player as well. If you look at what he did in that Tuchel team, he was pivotal to that team. That team's ticking over and how they actually operated and the structure that they had. I think it would be a smart signing. It will be interesting to see if it comes off. Chelsea are being ridiculous about it. And I know a lot's been made out in the press that United not being happy of how they've behaved over it, particularly when they obviously signed Sterling for 50 million last year when they had 1 year left on his contract. There's been a lot about how easy it was to sign Kovacic from Chelsea, and they obviously sold him for 30 million to Man City. It does seem like it's kind of inspired a little bit. The way they are kind of acting.
It's been called a United tax, hasn't it? It feels like a bit of a United tax because it's them.
Oh yeah. You
know? I don't think anyone other than a United fan believes that, if I'm totally honest. I think the fee is ridiculous that they're talking about for Mason Mount, but I think comparing it to Kovacic is impossible, because you're also talking about a homegrown player, an English player, which we know there's an English tax. It's not about it being United.
It's not.
If Man City had gone for Mason Mount, he would have been a lot more money than Kovacic. I don't think we've seen Mason Mount at his peak yet, whereas we kind of know what Kovacic's level is. It's a player that is homegrown to Chelsea as well. And I don't think you can let one of yours go that freely. Kovacic has come in, gone out, fine. 30 million in the last year of his contract is smart business. Mason Mount, I think there's still part of Chelsea that think if we keep hold of him this summer, we'll get a contract to him. And he's English. That's the tax. I don't think it's because it's Man United, if I'm honest.
I don't really want to prioritise midfield, though, to be honest. I think for me, if we're going to buy anyone, especially in this weird, uncertain position we're in without a definite ownership plan in place, why are we focusing on midfielders right now? I can see where he'd be a great sort of extra depth for us, especially as like maybe a replacement or a swap out for Christian Eriksen maybe. But for me, goalkeeper's number one, striker's number one, they're a lot more prominent for United in the wish list. So it just feels quite random.
I don't think it's just the English thing either. I think it's more potentially to do with the fact that Chelsea know that United aren't in a position of strength, really. They know we're on a fairly limited budget. They know that United need players, and we need players who are going to give us strength and depth. Mason Mount fits that profile.
So I think Chelsea are in a position of strength.
And they look at our history of overpaying over the last few years, particularly, over the last 10 years, and they're thinking, what every other club's been thinking. That with, if you look at last summer, we overpaid for Antony, we overpaid for Lissandro Martinez. So it's,
well, I don't know about that one.
Maybe not in hindsight.
Worth his weight in gold,
maybe
isn't it?
Not in hindsight. In, yeah, Lissandro Martinez now. Yeah, I don't think anyone envisaged him coming in and making that sort of impact. But if you look at how we have operated in the transfer market, it's no wonder that, you know, we're trying to get taken for mugs, really. And that we've only got ourselves to blame for that.
I'll be honest, I agree with you, Mike. I don't know if midfield would have been the first area I would have addressed with United. I think Mason Mount makes sense because I think you're right. I think he takes Eriksen's role because Eriksen, obviously, we know, struggles for full fitness, isn't going to play 90 minutes every week. It's going to be a long season with you back in the Champions League again as well. So I think it makes sense in that measure. The reason I don't think it makes sense to prioritise that right now is, like you said, Man United don't know what they can do this window. And I fear that every year we see at least one of the big clubs that you go, they've fallen behind everyone else because they've had a really bad transfer window. That looks like Man United this summer to me, if I'm honest. Because even the way they're approaching the Mason Mount deal, they've kind of gone in with, I think this is the third bid to Chelsea now, just kind of adding 5 million every time, which is, it's kind of how you first start negotiating when you start playing Football Manager. And then they've said to Chelsea, supposedly now, if the reports are to be true, okay, don't worry about it. That's our bid. If you don't want it, fine. We're going to go after Caicedo instead. Now, that might be a genius bit of negotiating because they know Chelsea want Caicedo and that could drive his price up, costing Chelsea more money. Or they might actually get him and then Chelsea miss out on a target. But if it's not that, then that's bizarre to me because Mount and Caicedo are completely different players. And it feels like if Mount it doesn't come through and you move to your second choice should be another ball-carrying midfielder who with a passing range. Not to say Caicedo can't do that, but if you're bringing him in, he's probably going to sit deeper than Mount would, right? So it seems like United are kind of lacking strategy right now. And that's not a surprise when we don't know who's going to be running the club. But think about everything we've seen Man United talk about this summer. Harry Kane, is that going to happen? That's gone dead quiet because United aren't going to put that kind of money in for a player of that age when they don't know who owns the club. If you own that club, putting a lot of money into Harry Kane is worth it because he'll bring you immediate success. But if you're going to sell in 3 months, you don't care about success next season. So you're not buying him. Buying a younger player at least is an asset. They're not going to go in for Osimhen because Napoli are putting a crazy price tag on him. So it's another target that United aren't going to do while they're in the middle of a takeover. There are obvious positions they need to strengthen. Goalkeeper, like you mentioned, we don't know what's going on. De Gea is still not confirmed properly yet that he signed a new deal. And United are trying to fight in a market that Chelsea and Spurs are fighting in right now without an owner kind of confirmed. So I feel like United could very much find themselves getting to the end of the transfer window. Maybe they'll get Mason Mount over the line and pay 65 million for him, which is what Chelsea say they want now. And then maybe we'll see a couple of free transfers. I just really worry that United are looking in all the wrong places right now and don't seem to have that clear of a strategy.
Yeah, that's the thing. It reminds me of previous summers where we feel like we've finished the season on a relative high and made some progress. You know, Jose Mourinho was exactly the same when he'd won trophies. He got the Europa League, didn't he? He got the League Cup. And you were thinking, this is something that could kick us on to more success. It's very similar to what we've achieved this season. And what did they do in the next transfer window? Literally barely anything, I think. And that was it.
The thing is, it's not, nothing's going to materialise as long as the club's, you know, kind of in this uncertainty of over its ownership. And it'll be deals in principle.
If that's the case,
it'll be deals in principle. They'll be speaking to players and saying, you know, we'll bring you in.
That's
when,
too late.
But that's what they can't do.
You'll miss players.
There's nothing they can
so
do.
If that's the case, why are they going for Mason Mount now? Why are they putting that kind of money into a player who's going to be out of contract in the summer?
He's obviously
no one else is in for Mount.
He's obviously
you could wait 12
months.
Well,
there was apparently Arsenal and Liverpool were interested in him, but he's made it clear he made it clear that he wanted to join Man United.
So he'll wait 12 months.
Yeah,
I feel like it's mental. I just think that the fact that United, yeah, I know that's what you're saying, that they'll get that if they can't get him done, then they'll get that agreement in for the summer. But they are trying to get it done now, and it's not their key priority. Eriksen could happily play another season, and they could get Mount on a free, and they could put that 50 million into Rasmus Højlund or someone. If they don't do that, then another club's going to take Højlund this summer. And then, who knows, maybe Mount signs a contract at Chelsea halfway through the season. It just feels like we keep seeing this this kind of backwards ideas. Kim Min-jae was done. Yeah. Was all done. And now he's going to Bayern. And United haven't gone in for another centre-back. Timber, they were desperate for him last summer. Why are they not competing with Arsenal for him now?
Yeah.
Are you telling me that he's changed the kind of player that he is now in the last 12 months to the point where Ten Hag, who knows him, hasn't gone, yeah, yeah, I still want him if he's available? I just feel like they don't really know what they're doing right now.
But no, if they had the money at the disposal, I've no doubt that Ten Hag would have a very clear picture of what he wants in the club, and there will be action in moves to make that happen. But as it stands, we've got a club in disarray. We've got arguably a board who are incompetent, players in certain positions on the board who aren't good enough to do what this club needs to be successful again. And we're just in an endless cycle. Really.
And on top of that, Dave, we're losing players for peanuts as well. Zidane Iqbal goes for £1 million. And he's worth, 10 times that at least.
I think it's been revealed, though, it was mentioned on social media today. I think somebody from Manchester Evening News mentioned that apparently there's a buyback clause and there's a 40% sell-on fee. So,
I don't know. I feel nervous that United have a really, really quiet summer, struggle to bring anyone in because of this position, and then we see Greenwood as their new striker next season. I feel like the club might panic. I know, but I honestly, and that would be really, really upsetting if that's the way that this is dealt with, that they kind of panic on everything else.
I think Dave's right.
We know there's no money. So where are these bids for Mason Mount coming from if there's no money? Where was the bid for Kim Min-jae if you then can't go in for Timber if that's who you wanted? That's what I can't get my head around.
Yeah.
You've obviously got some sort of budget. And I think that currently there's a lot coming out of United about players that are available for sale. And we know that United have had leaks for ages. So actually, when you read stuff like that, like the price tags on certain players, normally you go, oh yeah, the Sun or the Daily Mail have probably pulled that out of their backsides. But actually, I wonder if United are trying to say, this, come and get them. Because actually, the only way we're going to strengthen is if we get 40 million for Harry Maguire, if we get 45 million for Jadon Sancho, if we get 20 million for Anthony Elanga. That's what I've been reading. Apparently, they want 40 million for Scott McTominay as well, which I think is ambitious.
But the thing is, though, that's not strengthening, though. You're losing players and then gaining other players. So the squad is no deeper. You're actually losing depth to just sign different players. You're shuffling pieces of the same board. And it winds me up because I worry about what Erik ten Hag will be thinking about all of this. And it does feel like Jose Mourinho Mark II. I mean, a lot's been said about Jose Mourinho's time at United, and some fans were divided on him. But I loved him. I thought he was a born winner. He wanted a certain style and certain players, he didn't get them and ended up being the fall guy for a terrible regime. And I feel like Erik ten Hag is going down the same route. He identified Gakpo, didn't he, last season? Didn't get him. Mm-hmm. We were favourites for him for so long. He's gone to bloody Liverpool. So
Nunes
all of
too.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, there's so many players that you can see would really benefit us. Kim Min-jae, perfect. Andre Onana would be fantastic. Why are we not signing and sealing these players now? We know why. It's because we're in limbo and in flux. But
I also,
where do you draw the line?
I also wonder if Rabiot becomes an option again, because another one that he looked at all of last summer is on a free now, would play the Mason Mount role and save you some money to put somewhere else in the squad. And actually, he's in a better position than he was in last year he had a really good season.
There was something, there was a rumour today that we'd offered him a contract, but then I've seen something else today that's saying apparently he's ready to accept a renewal from Juve. Yeah. So,
yeah, potentially. Yeah. But Juve are in a sticky position as well. They've got to get some players off the books as well. I know that Di Maria's gone as well, but I don't know. I really wonder what United's strategy is this summer, because for every other club that we've talked about so far, it seemed that it's obvious what they're trying to do. And all right, there's a couple of basket cases, but United, I ain't got a clue what they're doing with Mason Mount and nothing. Nothing against Mason Mount, by the way. Well, yeah, maybe. Last summer, I thought you had a great window.
Yeah.
Look at the business you did last summer. That was brilliant. Although you missed out on a couple of key targets.
Yeah.
If someone had offered you Casemiro, Anthony, Lissandro Martinez at the start of last summer, you'd have bitten their hand off.
Yeah. But again, it happened with Jose. Had a great summer, signed a few really good players, and then literally nothing the next season. And I don't want to talk about this anymore. Let's move on. Let's talk about something more positive, because we're probably going to have a whole new round of this in about a week or two's time, where the situation hasn't changed. So,
or you've got Qatari owners and Mbappe's just signed.
Oh, God.
Let's talk about something a bit more positive, and that's England's young Lions. They've won both their first two games of the Euros, and in some style as well against the Czech Republic and Israel. They faced Germany for the final group game with nothing riding on it, thankfully. But the form they're in and the players and the way they're playing, we've already touched on a few, haven't we, in this podcast so far, that I kind of got something to prove. And it kind of shows, doesn't it? It's been a very attacking lineup from Lee Carsley so far, which, you know, I think fans crying out to see these players all in formation. And they've been brilliant. Their attacking forward interplay, Miles, has been really impressive so far. Who stood out for you, do you think? No bias here. Obviously, Jacob Rams is in the starting lineup for England. But anyone else?
Well, he didn't start the last one, annoyingly. He scored in the first game and then didn't start the second. No, Ramsey has been fantastic. Has to be mentioned. There's been so much talk about his performance in the first game against Czech Republic. There are a lot of people phoning into TalkSport saying he was better than Jude Bellingham, but probably won't go that far. No, there's a few players that I think have shone, and it's interesting because I mentioned Smith Rowe earlier, kind of struggling to get game time for Arsenal. He's come in, he's got a couple of goals, he's made a real impact. Anthony Gordon has looked much, much sharper, much more like his kind of old self that we remember from his breakthrough at Everton rather than the season we've just had. But that player that we kind of were praising all of the second half of last season is stealing the show right now, isn't he? Morgan Gibbs-White, who I remember this time last year, we were all completely baffled by the transfer fee that Forrest had paid for him. And now we're thinking, well, that was a stupid business, wasn't it? Because he looks like he could not only do a job for the rest of this tournament, but break into the senior men's team as well. Because I think he's been phenomenal.
He hasn't actually scored yet, has he? But he's been so central.
Three assists,
so central to the attacking play that... Yeah, it was two, wasn't it? Both in the same game. And it's just been so central to the way that the attack kind of plays around him. He creates so much space, but he's also a danger that you can't ignore. Dave, he's showed glimpses of that for Nottingham Forest in the running, hasn't he, as they escaped relegation. But with this kind of quality of players around him for the under-21s, it's really coming into his own, isn't he?
Yeah, and I think everyone's just delighted to see him playing so well and actually starting to fulfil some of his potential that he was kind of really earmarked for when he first burst onto the scene with Wolves. And, you know, he's had that really difficult period with Wolves where he wasn't getting enough game time. I think he went to Swansea on loan. And then it wasn't until last season when he went to Sheffield United and actually started to show, you know, glimpses of the player that we knew he could be. And, you know, he's continued this summer with playing really well. Obviously, you mentioned three assists, two assists in the game against Israel. And an Israel team are actually a really strong young team. I think he's created seven chances in the tournament, which is a top five in the tournament out of all the players. I think what he does offer as well is he's quite an experienced player. Like we forget he's still only 23, but that is quite a senior age. And there's a number of players in that England team actually that are in or around that sort of age. And I think that's why they're probably one of the favourites for the tournament, is because if you look at a lot of those players in that team, the likes of Noni Madueke, Angel Gomez, who a lot of people kind of forgotten about, almost a forgotten man, Emile Smith-Rowe, you know, Gibbs-White, Anthony Gordon, Curtis Jones, a lot of those players have had over 75 games for, you know, in first team football, which is, it was a big problem. If you looked many years ago, there was a problem where there are a lot of players weren't getting games, professional games for their clubs. And it was a well-known issue that I think the FA didn't really know how to rectify. And if you look at a lot of those players now, they're all playing first team football for their clubs. And I think that's just fabulous to kind of see. And I think that just shows kind of the strength that England do have as a national team at the minute, is a lot of these players could actually come into that first team, that, you know, the men's senior team, and make an impact.
Yeah, that midfield's insane, isn't it? How attacking it was. Like you say, Smith-Rowe and Madueke were so forward thinking as well. And again, both probably going to have quite a lot to play in their club's success this season, you'd imagine, with the amount of football that's going to be played. But Madueke in particular, I think looks great. And I think with Chelsea's troubles as well, he's got to play a role in whatever they do this season. It's been brilliant so far in the Euros.
Yeah, I think when you look at Chelsea's starting 11 now, Madueke has got to be in there because for all the players Chelsea have signed, they seem to have forgotten that the right wing exists. And they've let Hakim Ziyech go already this window. So Madueke kind of has nailed that position now. I think we've seen the best and the worst of him, though, in the tournament, if I'm totally honest. I think he looks really, really threatening. And he's a player that I've admired for a while. I was really hopeful that Villa were going to go in for him before Chelsea picked him up.
Yeah.
And I do think his ceiling is very high, but I still think there's a lot of maturity to come from him. I think you've seen a few times where he's had opportunities to maybe get his head up, look for a teammate, and he's very one focus. He's always got his mind on, where's the goal? I'm going for it.
He should have scored, actually.
Yeah, he should have scored two. He should have had two or three so far in the tournament, actually. But he also could have had a couple of assists. And I think he's got to learn to sharpen that up a little bit. And that'll come. And someone like Pochettino will definitely get the best out of him. We know that Pochettino's worked well with kind of younger, up-and-coming players like his profile before. You think about what he got out of someone like Dele Alli. Madueke could be the perfect one to kind of fill that gap for Pochettino at Chelsea. I think there's a few players that are kind of putting themselves in the shop window as well, though, right? Because we mentioned Smith Rowe when we were talking about Arsenal kind of struggling for game time. If he continues performing at the Euros, maybe clubs start looking at him again, because he's had a really injury hit season. I think some people would be forgiven for forgetting what kind of potential he had. Like when Saka came through, it was Saka, Smith Rowe and Nketiah, all three of them, wasn't it really?
True.
And Smith Rowe has definitely fallen to the back of that list somehow. And seeing him perform like this, it wasn't that long ago that Villa were putting bids in for him. I wouldn't be surprised if a club at that sort of level at least put a loan bid in. Maybe not permanent. I think Arsenal would be willing to let him go yet. But I'd be interested to see if he went out and got some more game time somewhere else.
I think what you were saying, Miles, about Arsenal having obviously all these players and they're in a position where they've kind of got to play them or they've got to find game time for them from elsewhere. There was an article, I think, yesterday about Erik ten Hag, and mentioned that he's only going to give game time to the very biggest talent in United's academy. He's only going to give the opportunity, which I can kind of see, you know, that's been an acceptable thing view to have, really. And if I think you've got to be fair to players, if you're not going to play them, if you can't guarantee them game time, and these players need that, then they should be looking elsewhere. But I feel like managers should be giving the opportunity to these players to play elsewhere, not kind of keep them hanging around. Because it's not just obviously keeping them, it's not going to create, hopefully, a kind of disharmony or anything in the squad. But it's kind of harming their learning curve and their development as well.
Absolutely.
Well, it could do.
We're in that position.
Depends on the character. Doesn't it? Yeah.
We've got exactly that dilemma with Cameron Archer at the moment, who is another one who's at the under-21s Euros, and he's not started either of the games yet. He did get an assist in the first game for Smith Rowe when he came on. He looked really sharp. So he can clearly have an impact on the tournament and could be playing Premier League football next year. But I don't know if Villa will give him the minutes that he needs. So I think a lot of these players will really enjoy being at this tournament, being able to showcase what they can do, and hoping that it's a platform for either them to go back to their club teams and kick on, or at least put them into other people's minds. And there's a few that I'd look at in that side, definitely.
Yeah, the Euros, I think, are a really good platform for players who are fighting to get into their teams, aren't they? It's that kind of age where your career could take a few different paths, isn't it, really, if you don't make it in the first team of your Premier League team. But yeah, really good statement from England's young lines so far. They're definitely among the favourites for the tournament as well, for the first time in a while at this age range as well. Under-21s hasn't been a particularly prolific tournament for them for a long, long time. So fingers crossed. There's a few other teams as well who are up there. France, obviously, being another one. Did you see Michael Olise scored for them and then got injured straight after in his game?
Shame for him.
That's well unlucky, isn't it? Yeah, shame for him. Really rubbish.
I was still kind of hoping he'd find his way back over to England.
Yeah,
been capped by the senior team, has he, yet? So I was still kind of hoping he might change his mind, but I don't think that's happening.
No, well, I think England are pretty blessed in the position that he wants, aren't they? So we'll see how they progress and see what difference it makes. But next time we talk, guys, we'll see what the transfer lay of the land looks like and who's gone where, and maybe zoom in on a few more players and where they would fit into their potential teams. But in the meantime, that's all there is to talk about this week. So thank you. Appreciate your time. If you are listening to this on whatever channel you may be listening to, whether it be Spotify or Apple Podcasts, please do us a massive, massive favour if you haven't already. Just hop over to YouTube, hit the subscribe button. With that close to 700 followers and subscribers on there, be a massive boost for us to get over the line, past the 700. And your support's really, really invaluable to that. So thank you so much. In the meantime, guys, thanks a lot. Speak to you soon.
See you soon.
Thanks.